Chapter 5. Sectional Conflict. In the middle decades of the 19th century, no country in the world was more interesting to other nations than the United States, and few attracted more distinguished visitors. The national territory now stretched over forest, plain, and mountain. Within these far-flung limits dwelt 23 million people in a union comprising 31 states. The land of promise had never before seemed so truly the land of performance. In the East, industry boomed. In the Midwest and the South, agriculture flourished. The railways knitted the settled parts of the country together, and the mines of California poured a golden stream into the channels of trade. Yet visitors quickly found that there was really two Americas, a North and a South, and the speed of progress itself held latent dangers for the maintenance of sectional harmony. Conflicting interests in North and South became increasingly apparent. Resenting the large profits amassed by northern businessmen from marketing the cotton crop, southerners attributed the backwardness of their own section to northern aggrandizement. Northerners, on the other hand, declared that slavery, the peculiar institution the South felt to be essential to its economy, was wholly responsible for the region's relative backwardness. From the middle 1840s, the slavery issue overshadowed all else in American politics. The South, from the Atlantic to the Mississippi River and beyond, was a relatively compact political unit, agreeing on all fundamental policies affecting cotton culture and slavery. The majority of Southern planters came to regard slavery as necessary and permanent. Cotton culture, using only primitive implements, was singularly adapted to the employment of slaves. It provided work 9 months of the year and permitted the use of women and children as well as men. Political leaders of the South, the professional classes, and most of the clergy, as they fought the weight of Northern opinion, now no longer apologized for slavery, but became its ardent champions. It was held to shower benefits upon the blacks, and Southern publicists insisted that the relations of capital and labor were more humane under the slavery system than under the wage system of the North. While many planters continued to treat their slaves kindly, there were instances of heartless cruelty, especially those involving the breaking of family ties. The most trenchant criticisms of slavery, however, was not the inhumanity of overseers, but the violation of every person's basic right to be free. Slavery increased concomitantly, and in national politics, Southerners chiefly sought protection and enlargement of the interests represented by the cotton slavery system. Anti-slavery Northerners saw in the Southern view a conspiracy for pro-slavery aggrandizement, and in the 1830s their opposition became militant. An earlier anti-slavery movement, an offshoot of the American Revolution, had won its last victory in 1808 when Congress abolished the slave trade with Africa. Extremists in the South urged that all the lands acquired from Mexico be thrown open to slaveholders. Strong anti-slavery Northerners demanded that all the new regions be closed to slavery. Southern opinion held that slavery had a right to exist in all the territories. The North asserted that it had a right in none. In 1848, nearly 300,000 men voted for the candidates of a Free Soil Party, which declared that the best policy was to limit, localize, and discourage slavery. Those who thought the slavery problem would solve itself were reckoning only with politicians and editors. Time proved that a single book published in 1852 would exert a far greater influence than legislators or the press. Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. The novel showed how inseparable cruelty was from the institution of slavery and how fundamentally irreconcilable were free and slave societies. The rising generation of voters in the North was deeply stirred by it. It inspired widespread enthusiasm for the anti-slavery cause among young and old, appealing as it did to basic human emotions, indignation at injustice and pity for the helpless individuals exposed to ruthless exploitation. At this point, Stephen A. Douglas, senior senator from Illinois, stirred up a storm by proposing a bill that enraged all free soil men. Douglas argued that since the Compromise of 1850 left Utah and New Mexico free to decide on slavery for themselves, the Missouri Compromise had long been superseded. His plan called for two territories, Kansas and Nebraska, and permitted settlers to carry slaves into them. The inhabitants themselves were to determine whether they should enter the Union as free or slave states. The immediate results of Douglass's ill-starred message was momentous. The Whig Party, which had straddled the question of slavery expansion, sank to its death, and in its stead a powerful new organization arose, the Republican Party, whose primary demand was that slavery be excluded from all the territories. In the presidential election of 1860, the Republican Party nominated Abraham Lincoln as its candidate. Party spirit soared as leaders declared that slavery could spread no further. The party also promised a tariff for the protection of industry and pledged the enactment of a law granting free homesteads to settlers who would help in the opening of the West. The disunity of the opposing Democrats, led by Stephen A. Douglas, helped the fledgling Republican Party win the election. South Carolina's secession from the Union, if Lincoln were elected, was a foregone conclusion, for the state had long been waiting for an event that would unite the South against the anti-slavery forces. Once the election returns were certain, a specially summoned South Carolina convention declared that the Union now subsisting between South Carolina and other states under the name of the United States of America is hereby dissolved. Other southern states promptly followed South Carolina's example, and on February 8, 1861, they formed the Confederate States of America. Less than a month later, on March 4, 1861, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as President of the United States. In his inaugural address, he refused to recognize the secession, considering it legally void. His speech closed with a plea for restoration of the bonds of union. But the South turned deaf ears, and on April 12th, guns opened fire on Fort Sumter in the Charleston, South Carolina harbor. All hesitation was now swept from the minds of the Northerners. The people of each section entered the war with high hopes for an early victory. In material resources, the North enjoyed a decided advantage. 23 states with a population of 22 million were arrayed against 11 inhabited by 9 million. The industrial superiority of the North exceeded even its preponderance in manpower, providing it with abundant facilities for manufacturing arms and ammunition, clothing, and other supplies. Similarly, the network of railways in the North contributed to federal military prospects. Most of the Navy at the war's beginning was in Union hands, but it was scattered and weak. Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles took prompt measures to strengthen it. Lincoln then proclaimed a blockade of the southern coasts. Although the effort of the blockade was negligible at first, by 1861 it was almost completely preventing shipments of cotton to Europe and the importation of munitions, clothing, and the medical supplies the South sorely needed. Meanwhile, a brilliant Navy commander, David Farragut, had conducted two remarkable operations. In the Mississippi Valley, the Union forces won an almost uninterrupted series of victories. In Virginia, on the other hand, Union troops had met one defeat after another, both sides suffering terrible losses. On January 1, 1863, President Lincoln issued an Emancipation Proclamation, freeing the slaves in the rebelling states and inviting them to join the armed forces of the North. The proclamation thus declared the abolition of slavery, an objective of the war in addition to the declared objective of saving the Union. July 1863 brought the turning point of the war. The Confederacy was nearing the end of its resources. The northern states, on the other hand, seemed more prosperous than ever. Their mills and factories were running full blast. Their farms were exporting bumper crops to Europe. Their manpower was being restored by immigration. General Grant's slow but inexorable advance on Richmond in 1864 foreshadowed the end. On February 17th, the Confederates abandoned Columbia, the South Carolina capital. Without a battle, Charleston fell into the hands of the Union fleet when her railroad connections with the interior were cut. Meanwhile, the Confederate positions in Petersburg and Richmond proved untenable, and on April 2nd, Lee abandoned them. A week later, at Appomattox, Virginia, hemmed in by the enemy, he had no alternative but surrender. For the North, the war produced a still greater hero in Abraham Lincoln, a man eager above all else to weld the Union together again, not by force and repression, but by warmth and generosity. Although he had to use unprecedented powers both in war and in peace, he never infringed upon the principles of democratic self-government. In 1864, he was elected for a second term as president. On Friday evening, April 14th, Lincoln, with his wife and a young couple who were his guests, attended a performance at Ford's Theater. There, as he sat in the presidential box, he was assassinated by a crazed actor, John Wilkes Booth. Lincoln died in a downstairs bedroom of a house across the street from Ford's on the morning of April 15th. To deal with one of its major concerns, the condition of the now emancipated black, Congress in March 1865 established the Freedmen's Bureau to act as guardian over black citizens and guide them toward self-support. And in December of that year, the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolished slavery. Throughout the summer of 1865, Vice President Johnson had proceeded to carry out Lincoln's Reconstruction Program with minor modifications. This denial came to pass when, under the leadership of Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, those congressmen who sought to punish the South refused to seat its duly elected senators and representatives. Then, within the next few months, the Congress proceeded to work out a plan of Southern Reconstruction, quite different from the one Lincoln had started and Johnson had continued. Wide public support gradually developed for those members of Congress who felt that the blacks should be given the full benefits of citizenship. By July 1866, Congress had passed a civil rights bill and set up a new Freedmen's Bureau, both designed to prevent racial discrimination by Southern legislators. Following this, the Congress passed a 14th Amendment to the Constitution, stating that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the states in which they reside. In the Reconstruction Act of March 1867, the Congress, ignoring the governments that had been established in the southern states, divided the South into five districts and placed them under military rule. Escape from permanent military government was open to those states that established civil governments, took an oath of allegiance, ratified the 14th Amendment, and adopted black suffrage. The 15th Amendment, passed by Congress the following year and ratified in 1870 by state legislatures, provided that the rights of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. As time passed, it became more and more obvious that the problems of the South were not being solved by harsh laws and continuing rancor against former Confederates. In 1877, President Rutherford B. Hayes removed them, thereby admitting the failure of the radical Reconstruction policy. Northern rule was ended in the South, but the South was now a region not only devastated by war, but also burdened by debt caused by misgovernment and demoralized by a decade of racial warfare. After 12 years of false Reconstruction, from 1865 to 1877, real efforts to rebuild the South began.
听力课堂，欢迎你。
听力课堂，欢迎你。
听啊，点儿啊。